Oh, thank God it is Friday. It's an exciting day in the news, definitely over the last few years, and also exciting because tomorrow is Saturday. And on Saturday's edition of the show, I will be watching Frasier. But anyway, for today, we do have a lot of news to get to. And joining me to do that, Brett Ehrlich.
I just want to point out that today, before the show, we spent a lot of time talking about Frasier.
We did, and then we went
away from Frasier and did our work. And then you were like, did you know that Kelsey Grammer did a show on FX with Martin Lawrence?
I had not known that. You learn something new every day on this show, usually about Kelsey Grammer. But anyway, I'm rewatching. It's my show that I watch during work to drown out the noise of literally everyone talking simultaneously. We're going to be talking semi-simultaneously on the show about a number of important topics, including Donald Trump's feud with his intelligence chiefs, which is extremely difficult to follow, but we're going to do our best to try to. We've got a new entrant into the Democratic primary in 2020. It was a pretty empty field. Good to see it starting to get bulked out a little bit. Senators and stuff.
None bulkier than Cory Booker.
That's true. We will be breaking down his bulk a little bit later on. He's in very good shape, far better than me, so I feel like we can make that joke if we want. Then, a little bit later on, opioid epidemic, obviously very bad. One horrendous aspect of that is how much some people are making off of selling these drugs. But wait until you find out the next way they intend to make money. It's even worse than the original tragedy. Along the way, by the way, we're gonna have two awesome guests. So first, a documentary that goes in depth into the mental health care field, sort of nationally, but with a focus on a Los Angeles institution. Really dark stuff that they've uncovered. It is premiering at Sundance. We're gonna have one of the producers for the documentary on to break it down. That's Bedlam. And then later on, birthday boy Ken Klippenstein is gonna be on the show to break down his most recent reporting on some of the safety investigations of fatal accidents that did not happen because of the shutdown that we are recently out of, and that could be suspended again in the next few weeks if we enter another shutdown. And then, and I really hope that we have time for this, the stupidest things I've ever heard said about renewable energy to close out the show. And Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez responds. So with that, anything else you wanted to say about Kelsey Grammer?
No, that's all right.
So he
played Frasier for 20 years. He played
That's a long time. On three shows, by the way.
The third one being.
So don't say, tweet us at the Damage Report. The third show that he played.
I would even go so far as to say, go follow us on Facebook. We would like to build our Facebook presence. So I would just request that people go leave a comment on Facebook at damage at facebook.com/thedamagereporttyt. It's on the bottom of the screen.
If they can't see that, there's literally no chance they're gonna get to that at this point. Facebook.com/thedamagereporttyt. You can post things about politics or about Frasier or Niles. Daphne.
I woke up with my phone stuck to my belly this morning. That's why I'm a little off.
Okay, so we're gonna turn now to domestic news. The Democratic primary just got even more primary-ish with Cory Booker, a senator announcing that he is in fact going to be running, surprising everyone because they had not been thinking that this was going to happen. So obviously he was gonna run, and he is running. He announced it with a video on Twitter that's receiving pretty good reviews. Here's a section of his announcement video.
We are better when we help each other. The history of our nation is defined by collective action, by interwoven destinies of slaves and abolitionists, of those born here and those who chose America as home, those who took up arms to defend our country, and those who linked arms to challenge and change it. I believe that we can build a country where no one is forgotten, no one is left behind. Where parents can put food on the table, where there are good paying jobs with good benefits in every neighborhood, where our criminal justice system keeps us safe instead of shuffling more children into cages and coffins, where we see the faces of our leaders on television and feel pride, not shame. It is not a matter of can we, it's a matter of do we have the collective will, the American will. I believe we do. Together, we will channel our common pain back into our common purpose. Together, America, we will rise. I'm Cory Booker, and I'm running for president of the United States of America.
Okay, so we're gonna get into both his history, the experience that leads to him running for presidency. We're gonna talk a little bit about his platform. But first, the video. What'd you think?
this is exactly what I consider to be wrong with Cory Booker.
What's that?
It's just a little much. He's got the drum line, and he's got the almost yes we, as you pointed out while that was playing, the almost yes we can, and then he's got the we will rise, and it's just so many things. Because throughout his his past, Cory Booker is what, sorry, and I got it right, Cory Booker is a duck. He's a duck. It's a term for someone who wants to see, like if you think of a duck, they're very mellow on the surface. But just below the surface, their legs are kicking like crazy. Uh-huh. That's Cory Booker. He's trying so hard to do everything so right. And it's not evil. It's not bad. It's just like a little much.
Yeah. No, it's evil. Okay? No, it's not evil. Look. I would have put some other things into the video. There are hints of a platform there. He talks about certain topics and focuses on some elements and not others. That can give you an idea of his platform. That is true. Overall, I would say that if I'm speaking not as a person who literally spends most of the day thinking about and talking about politics, but as a regular person, I think that seems like a really good ad, a really good announcement. If I don't know much about Cory Booker, if I don't know much about the other candidates, I think that's pretty good. Now, I will say, I find if you're a person who we know has been thinking about running for president for literally years, and this is true of Howard Schultz too, every time when they announce, they then say, here's why I'm running, and it's something super timely and true of now. No, but you've been thinking about it for years. You're not running because now there's this issue. You want to, that's fine. You can be ambitious. Yeah. Everyone who runs for the presidency is. That's the video. Let's talk a little bit about who he is. He's a former mayor of Newark, New Jersey, a former Stanford football player, which caught your eye.
He led the charge in the big upset in 1990 against Notre Dame. He caught the touchdown pass, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah,
at some point or
that
another.
Is exciting. He also has a history of doing, and I'm not trying to like judge them here, but stunts basically, politically. So
performative.
Performative stunts. So he went on a 10-day hunger strike during his mayoral run to bring attention to housing issues. Went on food stamps to show how difficult it is, which a few people have done, but he did it too. Shoveled a constituent's driveway, you found reference to this. And also ran into a burning building to save his neighbor.
Yes.
They never caught the person who set the building on fire. I'll just point that out.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. I have no idea. I'm sure he did not set fire to the building. But that's exciting, I guess.
Yeah, I don't mind Cory Booker in terms of like his policy over. I don't know. He does his homework, and he has pieced together like a lot of things that on paper seem fine. For me, it's just like there's this the affect in his voice as he's saying, "Oh, you know what? Mm-hmm. I just believe in America. Mm-hmm. I just don't like that forcedness. I want to hear." It's an authenticity test. And so when I go through like my like things I want in a candidate, I want someone who authentically believes all the things I believe. Mm-hmm. And if I don't get that, I want someone who has been forced through their sheer ambition into a position where they are echoing things that my side has fought for very hard to ensure that that is their platform.
Yeah.
And Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, they are in the latter category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, look, it's interesting because he has this weird mix of obvious, like he's, I think, a relatively charismatic guy, but he doesn't quite seem authentic at almost any point. It all seems a little bit performative, a little bit planned. And he's a politician. There is going to be some of that. Now, in terms of his record, in general terms, there are some measures of ideology in the Senate that put him in third. Ideologically most liberal senator. Sometimes it's less than that. It really depends on how you score things. In terms of what he's going to be running on, Jeff Stein, talking to his aide, says his focus is going to be baby bonds to wipe out the wealth gap, sweeping criminal justice reform, antitrust action, legalizing marijuana, which is something he talks about a lot, pilot program for job guarantees at the federal level, housing tax credits, a Green New Deal, and Medicare for all.
He's very smart and very creative. So there's a lot of initiatives he launched in New Jersey that were innovative and helped with housing situations. Mm-hmm. He does do all the work. Mm-hmm. I don't know, there's just something about him. And I don't hate him by any means.
No. Now, again, as with, when just a few days ago, Kamala Harris said that she supports the Green New Deal, We still need to know what that means. So the Sunrise Movement, just like they did with her, tweeted, "We're glad that Cory Booker has backed a Green New Deal, including a jobs guarantee and moving to 100% clean energy by 2030. As he kicks off his campaign, we're eager for him to share his vision for a Green New Deal, sign the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge." So I had not heard that he had apparently called for moving to 100% clean energy by 2030. I'm gonna have to actually find that quote, but they're saying that he said it, so that's fine. The issue with him is, obviously, he has a longstanding relationship with Wall Street and the financial industry. Not really surprising with him being from New Jersey. There is the fear that that will continue, both in terms of his funding for this campaign and also in terms of setting policies and regulations were he to become president. He also has the problem that he faces that there are a lot of people already declared in this that are sort of similar to him in various ways in terms of their platform, not necessarily their experience, but the way they communicate about these issues. Like, there is a glut of senators this time around that I think are gonna kind of pull votes from each other.
Yeah, I think
Gillibrand and Kamala Harris and others.
I think he and Kamala during the Kavanaugh hearings were the ones who stepped up and were kind of front and center when it came to grilling Kavanaugh, mm-hmm. and Kamala just did a better job. Mm-hmm. They're both lawyers, they're both really, really smart people, but Kamala just did a better job of getting up there and making it an episode of Law and Order, mm-hmm. which is what people want to watch.
Yeah.
Whereas Cory just has this, in Spanish they would call it empujo. He just like pushes a little too hard with mm-hmm. everything that he does.
Interesting. Okay, again, you learn something new every day. So yeah, look, obviously we're in the very beginning. He just launched. We're gonna see how his first week goes, compare it to some of the others. We'll start breaking down his policies, his funders more as time goes on. It does seem like he has a tough path ahead of him. But you know, he's been wanting this for a while, so. Yeah. I'm sure he'll forge ahead. Anyway, with that, we are going to take our first break. When we come back, producer for the upcoming documentary Bedlam, which breaks down the mental health care situation in America, will be joining us. This is Peter Miller after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Premiering at Sundance, Bedlam is a documentary that explores the crisis of mental health care in America. And one of its producers, Peter Miller, joins us on the Damage Report now. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm very excited to talk to you about this. This is not a topic that we hear too often at the national level, a big conversation about this. And so documentaries like yours are certainly helpful. I want to start off with a question about the filming and creation of the documentary, because I was very interested in the fact that you, the team apparently captured footage at an LA area institution for literally years. And I'm curious what that sort of extended access, how that might have changed your like what you were able to discover about the stories that you're profiling.
Well, the crisis in care of the severely mentally ill is a absolutely important story and one which people rarely, rarely hear. Fortunately, this project was spearheaded by a filmmaker who was also a psychiatrist, Ken Rosenberg, who through great persuasive powers and persistence was able to get access to the USC Los Angeles County Medical Center and film for 5 years in the emergency room, in the busiest psych emergency room in the country, where we meet people who are in crisis and then follow them for years and years, seeing what it is like to be mentally ill in America today.
Could you tell us, give us an idea of some of the people that you've profiled, what sorts of different stories you focused on in this documentary?
Well, one thing to understand is that our mental health system is really in a state of disarray, and the film is called Bedlam for good reason. Our biggest psychiatric care facilities in the country are our three biggest jails, you know, LA Twin Towers and Rikers Island in New York and Chicago's Cook County Jail. There are the 500,000 people who used to live in asylums, which were terrible places, but still provided some kind of care. There's no longer that system. It's all been broken down. And the people who are in crisis often, if they don't go to jail, they go to the emergency room. And in the emergency room, we were able to find a handful of people who were generous to let us into their lives and follow them home, one of whom, a gentleman named Monty, a beautiful, gentle person, but with severe mental illness, found we meet and we follow him as his family takes care of him. His sister is really the rock who, and his family takes care of him and supports him. Couple of years into filming, coming out of her work of supporting her brother, his sister Patrice Cullors founds Black Lives Matter, which comes out of her work supporting a person with serious mental illness who is not getting the kind of care that he should be getting in our broken healthcare system.
That is actually really amazing. So you started to get into this in your answer. You talked about some of the institutional change historically in the sorts of facilities these people might end up in, where previously you had these more long-term care facilities. Now some might end up in prison. And in some of the interviews about the documentary, the team talked about how now prisons and jails are sort of a big part of this system. Can you talk a little bit about some of the effects of that?
Well, the worst place to get care if you're mentally ill is on the street, if you're homeless or in jail or prison. And yet, by default, our psychiatric care facilities of first resort tend to be our prisons. We've got a large disproportionate share of people who are in jails and in prisons are suffering with severe mental illness. And for some people, that's the only place where they can get care. Which is crazy.
So I know that documentaries like Bedlam are one way that some of the stigma around mental illness and mental health care can start to be broken down. I'm curious that as you've been doing research into the history of this, has there been much change in American individually and sort of nationally, our willingness to look at this sort of problem, to see these people as individuals that are deserving of help? Has there been much change over the past few decades?
Well, I think that's probably, you've really hit on what the critical thing to create a movement to make change is for people to step out of the shadows and say, the stigma and the shame surrounding mental illness is a problem and it's holding us back. You know, other diseases, you know, HIV, breast cancer, other terrible diseases, people have managed to shake off the stigma and say, this is a disease that requires national attention. This is a crisis that requires care. And that's a huge number of Americans. There's 15 million American families that have serious mental illness in their family. If we don't step up and say, we are an undaunted, unashamed community, we're never going to be able to create the kind of movement that will insist on the change that we need to make this system what it should be.
And it certainly seems like it is overdue to have such a lingering sort of like system of silence about something that affects so many families. Hopefully, Bedlam will be successful in helping to open up the conversation a little bit. Peter Miller, producer for Bedlam, thank you for joining us. Certainly looking forward to
it. It's a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Donald Trump has launched into a conflict with the chiefs of the various intelligence bureaus in the US. Let's see if we can figure out who's actually telling the truth after this. There's something about intelligence agencies in the US government that Donald Trump is just a little bit suspicious of, a little bit hostile towards. There's maybe something there. And this week, his war on these intelligence agencies grew to new levels of nonsense when some of them, including the DNI, the head of the CIA, testified before Congress around the release of a new threat assessment on global threats to the United States. And in their quotes about various national threats that we face, it became clear that much of what Donald Trump has talked about in these cases apparently is not actually founded on intelligence being gathered at the national level. So on North Korea earlier this week, they said it was unlikely to give up its nuclear arsenal, even after Mr. Trump's diplomacy with Mr. Kim. On Iran, which Mr. Trump has painted as an implacable enemy, they said it's not taking steps to manufacture a nuclear bomb. And they said that Mr. Trump's trade policies and unilateralism had strained the US's alliances. On one particular moment on North Korea, Senator Kamala Harris, talking with Gina Haspel, asked whether North Korea has shown any signs of changing its behavior after all of this letter writing and meetings and all of that. Haspel affirmed the intelligence community's assessment, saying, "I don't think I can point to any specific changes over the past couple of years." That obviously goes against what he has been saying even recently on North Korea. On ISIS, they said, this is Dan Coats, director of national intelligence, "While ISIS is nearing territorial defeat in Iraq and Syria, the group has returned to its guerrilla warfare roots while continuing to plot attacks and direct its supporters worldwide. ISIS is intent on resurging and still commands thousands of fighters in Iraq and Syria." That undercuts a little Donald Trump's claim that we have defeated ISIS, that it is utterly destroyed and been driven away from him after all that he's done. In addition, by the way, a small note, I just feel the need to mention it. The 42-page report, the threat assessment, refers to climate change as a threat to infrastructure, health, and water and food security. So maybe something we should pay attention to. Now, very quickly after they gave those quotes, talking with Congress, New York Times reported that Trump received the report, quote, as a scorecard on his foreign policy and something close to an affront. I think it's actually an affront, but he took it as apparently something close to an affront. And so he immediately began lashing out against it. Now, understand, when he attacks this report and says it's inaccurate, bear in mind this quote, "I didn't see the report from the intelligence. When you read it, it's a lot different than what is covered in the news." So he's going to criticize it, even though he hasn't seen it. And when you see it, understand that it's different from what's being covered in the news, even though he doesn't know what's in it and really only pays attention to Fox News. So we're going to get to his tweets attacking both the report and initially what they said in these conferences in just a second. But what was your reaction to this?
He didn't read the report.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
to be fair, it's 42 pages.
It's 42 pages, but the first five pages are the cover because I looked through it. The first five pages are like the cover and the table of contents. And in the report, they literally have bold sections that are like, if you don't want to read the rest, here's the first line of every paragraph is in bold. Yeah. And within it, it just points out the important things. But that's not what he's concerned about. He's concerned about you thinking that he is winning. Mm-hmm. And anything that implies otherwise, he wants to attack.
Yeah.
And you'll watch the development of people getting to a room where they sit down with him and committing and communicating to him that actually it's not us that contradicted you, it's other people that contradicted you. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be like the key art of being in this White House
with him.
Convincing the president that whoever said you're not winning is wrong, and it definitely wasn't me. Mm-hmm. And after he sits down with those people, he just basically acts on what he saw or heard last.
Yeah.
And you'll see that play out.
Exactly. So before we get to that point, though, the attacks. So he's sitting in executive time, and he's watching the head of the CIA, DNI, and all that undercut his arguments in virtually every conflict that he's engaged in so far in his presidency. And he doesn't like it because in the news, they're picking this up and saying, hey, this directly undercuts what the president has been saying. So he says, the intelligence people seem to be extremely passive and naive when it comes to the dangers of Iran. They are wrong. When I became president, Iran was making trouble all over the Middle East and beyond. Since ending the terrible Iran nuclear deal, they are much different. But a source of potential danger and conflict. That doesn't sound much different. They are testing rockets last week and more and are coming very close to the edge. their economy is now crashing, which is the only thing holding them back. Be careful of Iran. Perhaps intelligence should go back to school. Well, somebody should, that's for sure. So the intelligence people are being passive and naive. Now, the thing is, like, I am not involved in this government. I don't have to trust what the CIA says about Iran's nuclear program, what the DNI says about it. I can question whether they know exactly what they're talking about. But hypothetically, they were chosen by Donald Trump to hold these positions. He talked to them about these conflicts. I'm sure ideologically they are at least somewhat overlapping. If they had evidence that Iran was building nuclear weapons, I think they would mention that. So for him to say they're naive in their intelligence report, which I refuse to even look at, that seems short-sighted.
Right, but in Donald Trump's opinion, what you said is he chose them, they're probably ideologically overlapping with him. Yeah, that's true. But in Donald Trump's appraisal situation, they were chosen to tell Donald Trump what he wants to hear. Mm-hmm. And they've learned that, but I think what's happening is they have written their report and the report says here is exactly what is happening on the ground. And that includes, like, Iran is still abiding by the nuclear deal that we made with them. Mm-hmm. And even though we pulled out of it, they are still abiding by it. And Trump's going to completely gloss over that. But in the end, he just wants to hear what he wants to hear. And they will tell it to him in a sit-down meeting.
Yeah.
And that's...
Yeah, they'll do that. Like, don't you care what's actually happening? Are they developing nuclear weapons? Are they not developing nuclear weapons?
He became president by acting on the perception of what's happening and crafting the perception of what's happening.
And here's the thing. This feels very much like yesterday on the show, we were breaking down his rhetoric around the wall. Mm-hmm. And it really is, it's moving in every direction simultaneously. We desperately need money because it's an emergency, or we don't need money because it's already been built and much of it is being built. We can stop the caravans already, but oh no, wait, actually it would be much easier with the wall, so we definitely need a wall.
Did you see the update to his latest statement, which is after all the things, and everyone needs to go listen to the podcast or watch the videos from yesterday, but he literally said, I believe I've set the table quite nicely.
Yeah, with hamburgers.
By just taking the tablecloth and throwing it in the air.
Yeah, and here it's Iran was super dangerous. I became president. They're super dangerous. Now it's much better. Wait, no, they're still gonna cause a lot of problems and they need to be contained. They're really dangerous. Actually, because of what I did, their economy is crashing, so they're screwed. But still, they could bounce back from that. It's like, if you're a supporter of this president and you want to travel in the same road that he's on, it's very difficult mentally to do that. But as you said, he's eventually gonna figure out a way to work through this, possibly because Dan Coats and Gina Haspel, they know a little bit about how to deal with him. So this is what we get this morning. And bear in mind, everything that we just said, him being furious at their testimony, him saying they need to go back to school because of what they wrote in a report that he refuses to read, which is very different than what you hear in the news, which is all that, he doesn't need a daily briefing. He watches Fox and Friends. What more intelligence does he need than that? Then they have a meeting and he says this, just concluded a great meeting with my intel team in the Oval Office who told me that what they said on Tuesday at the Senate hearing was mischaracterized by the media. And we are very much in agreement on Iran, ISIS, North Korea, etc. Their testimony was distorted press. I would suggest you read the complete testimony from Tuesday, which I refuse to do. A false narrative is so bad for our country. I value our intelligence community. Happily, we had a very good meeting and we were all on the same page. So he very much values the intelligence community that he called extremely passive, naive, and needing to go back to school, and says that they were mischaracterized. We showed you the video at the time. You could see it. We read some of the quotes on today's show. I don't know how you mischaracterize a direct quote undercutting a talking point of the president. It reminds me of the decades-long attacks against Media Matters by people like Bill O'Reilly. They get pissed off that Media Matters puts video of him speaking up on their website.
Yes.
These are all extremely important situations. The current state of nuclear weapons development in Iran, the state of our relationship with North Korea, whether they're actually gonna denuclearize, all the current state of ISIS, how much of a threat are they still? These are incredibly important actual situations.
But is that the meeting? There's gotta be a meeting. They have their intelligence meeting. Everyone reports on what they've learned. They're like, all right, we put this in the report. I'm gonna publish it so that everyone within the intelligence community, and as that is related based on infrastructure completely independent of the president, we can make sure that we're addressing these things. And then we'll figure out, you guys deal with that. then we're going to go sit at the Resolute desk with the president for this photo op so he can freaking tweet about it.
Yeah.
And then I'll say, oh, the media is what's wrong, because we know once we say that it's like a get out of jail free card, it like restores the factory settings and he's back to, oh, that is a version of reality I'm familiar with advocating against. Mm-hmm. So I am fine. Let's all go our separate ways. But that's my frustration with the president, especially like working on the show and everything, is the, oh my God, do I have to say this aspect of it?
Yeah.
It's like what he did is so obviously ridiculous in every possible way. Do I have to point that out?
Mm-hmm.
Ugh, do I have to go to him and say the media is actually warping our words
because
I know he's not going to go read the words?
Yeah.
I guess I have to.
They should have had a section where they just summed up our relationship with each country with an emoji. And by the way, the cherry on top of all of this, he said after they came out of the meeting that the intelligence people said that it was fake news. Yeah, they said that. You didn't say that. That was Dan Coats said it was fake news. Anyway, we are going to have to take a break. But when we come back, Ken Klippenstein is going to join us. Some more fallout from the recently shuttered shutdown after this. So we can name many ways that the shutdown was damaging to the United States. And in fact, we did that week after week after week. But it turns out the damage went even further into new areas. And joining us now to break down one of those is Ken Klippenstein of 218 Investigates. Ken, welcome to the show.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
And by the way, happy birthday, buddy.
Yay.
Thanks, man.
Great to have you on and for you to make time for us, especially on your birthday. So I want to talk to you about your recent story that's now available at 2IT.com. And that has to do with investigations that were shuttered during the shutdown. So what were you able to find out, and how exactly did you gain access to this information?
A whistleblower within the Transportation Regulatory Authority, NTSB for short, reached out to me. And he was concerned that the public wasn't going to get an accurate assessment of what exactly happened during the shutdown. Because unfortunately, you know, news cycles being what they are, we move on to the next bit of insanity and people sort of forget. But what the memo that he sent me, which was internal to the NSTB, showed was that there were hundreds of fatalities related to accidents that were not investigated during the shutdown. And this individual's concern is that this government authority is tasked with looking at, you know, trains, planes, marine incidents, and they have to kind of look at what went wrong. How do we fix this so that doesn't happen again? You know, whether it's with the, you know, railroad or subway or whatever it is. And those things didn't get looked into. And obviously, if there's something wrong with, you know, this train or subway or whatever it is, that could happen again. And so this person was very concerned that those things might not get looked into themselves, and that going forward in the next shutdown, you know, this would happen again.
Yeah, and so you talk about different categories of investigations. It's hundreds and hundreds of investigations that were suspended during this. And going over it, it was kind of like a, hey, remember that of tragic news stories over the past year or two. What were some of the standout stories that people might not even know are still being investigated, or at least were up until the shutdown?
Well, one interesting one was there was, I think it was a US Navy boat had some kind of incident, and they had to ask the British to come and look at it because we didn't have the resources to look at our own military naval vessels when that went wrong. So the British were able to do that. As you point out, there were a lot of local incidents. I got so many emails, phone calls, messages from people in Florida, in Ohio, elsewhere, in California. They were like, oh my God, I saw that thing on the news. I can't believe that they didn't investigate that. That's really scary. Because they would describe this being, you know, a days long local news story where say there was a bus that you know, a public bus that hit a maybe hit a car and killed like four people, something like that. And everyone, you know, and I think maybe that was in Orlando. They were like, wow, this is a huge story for like a week here. I can't believe they didn't look into it. And so the public seemed very concerned and, you know, wanted to do something about it, but they just didn't know that it hadn't gotten looked into. So there were all kinds of incidents like that.
So I'm sure what a lot of people are probably wondering as they're listening to this, did while you're doing this investigation, the NTSB, did they provide any information about what this slowdown in the investigations, how that will be dealt with? And if in 2 weeks we do enter into a second shutdown, how are they going to deal with that?
That was this individual's concern. You know, everyone's cheering for Pelosi, you know, having ended it, but we're not really out of the woods yet, guys. Trump, if he wants to, could very easily, you know, shutter the government again, even though, you know, the polling numbers show that that's not what people and even, you know, a lot of Republicans don't want. This president doesn't worry so much about what people want, I don't think. So I don't think we should, you know, take any solace in the fact that it would be expedient to his purposes to do that. He might just not care and do it again. Wow. And anyway, so to answer your question, this regulatory authority, they're supposed to go back and investigate these things. First of all, this is weeks after, so that's, you know, not ideal in itself. But the other thing is they already have a whole bunch of other things they're supposed to do. And I heard this from other agencies. Just because they're back online, they've lost, you know, 3 weeks from their annual time to do what they're supposed to do. They may not have time to actually get to everything. So it's unclear if they'll even have time to go back and investigate all these things.
Well, and related to that, speaking of having time to do all the things they have to do, I'm sure you have other stories that you're developing right now. But if in a couple of weeks we do end up launching into a second shutdown, hopefully you'll have some time to do investigations there. Is there anything that you are going to be on the lookout for if that unfortunately does happen?
Absolutely. I'll be looking at our food safety measures. I'm going to be looking at this, of course, the transportation regulation stuff.
Wow.
And then FAA, which is extremely important. You know, I had FAA sources saying, you know, I would never fly during a shutdown. I can tell you that. And, you know, described to me some very frightening incidents, not all of which I was able to write about. So these are all things that I do think the public cares about a lot when they hear about it, but there's not, unfortunately, you know, as much scrutiny as I think there should be. Yeah. Much of the scrutiny seems to be on the White House, which is understandable, but, you know, that's not all there is.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, if you continue doing investigations, there will always be a place for a discussion of that on the Damage Report.
And I appreciate it, John.
Anytime. And thank you for joining us. And again, happy birthday.
Thanks a lot, man. Take it easy.
We're going to take one last break. We come back. Some of the stupidest stuff I've ever heard on solar panels, climate change, and the Green New Deal after this. The polar vortex has apparently frozen some people's brains because it is causing them to say really, really dumb stuff about renewable energy, climate change related topics. I bring to you this piece of evidence, a tweet from Jim Holt at Gateway Pundit saying, "It's a bit cold outside this morning in middle America. Aren't you glad you aren't heating your home with a solar panel like nitwit socialist AOC is demanding?" And as evidence, because he lives in an evidence-based world, he shows you there it is, in fact, -4 degrees. That is cold. I mean, with wind chill, probably even colder. You see, it's going to be later today, -24. And he makes a good point. But wait, hold on. Guys in the control room, can you enhance that image? Because wait, zoom in? A little bit more? Oh, what do you know? It's a yellow ball. Okay? It's not quite a light bulb over someone's head, but it is something interesting. It's sunny even when it's cold. So, Brett, I was shocked to find out that solar cells don't produce energy by absorbing ambient heat. They use solar energy, which comes from the sun, which exists even in winter.
I don't even know where to start with this.
Let's start with this. I say this all the time, I'm not a mind reader, but he definitely thought, I've got them.
Oh, absolutely.
There's
just this disconnect between rational thought, mm-hmm. which jokes are typically based on. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's like a ridiculous jump in logic to emphasize how ridiculous someone else is being, but this is a ridiculous jump in logic because they just so desperately want to own the libs. Mm-hmm. He knows, and the through line of all of this is they know there are certain buzzwords and kinds of jokes out there that they want to tell and they want to hear, but they won't figure out what makes those jokes work if they ever work. Mm-hmm. And rather, they will just kind of repeat the words that are in those jokes. So in this situation, it's like libs. Solar panels don't work when there's no sun out, which usually happens when it's cold, mm-hmm. but he will utterly disregard the fact that sometimes it's cold and the sun's out, and the solar panels, get this, work by using the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And libs don't just want to use the sun. Of course we understand that it's night sometimes, but built into the infrastructure of building this electricity future, we account for that.
Yeah.
And it's and you guys think, because you just happened upon this, that it's cold, solar panels, AOC, I've got all the makings of a tweet.
Yeah.
That you can tweet it out and somehow be utterly immune from the backlash of you being a freaking idiot.
Yeah, it's gonna hurt for a while. He's not admitting it yet, but it is gonna be difficult.
Last thing on this is on that tweet specifically is, like, unfortunately there are a lot of people who will go, lol.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, not everybody hated it. I mean, he's gateway pundit. Like, it is sort of a self-selected group of people who will accept this sort of thing and think that it's good. But it is fundamentally on the same level as taking a picture outside at midnight and saying, how can there be solar energy when there's no sun? It's the same thing. Now, that was not lost on a lot of the people. Now, understand, there, he wasn't just attacking solar panels. He was using the solar panel attack to take down Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who, of course, is pushing for a Green New Deal, which I looked into it, isn't just about building solar panels. It goes a little bit deeper than that. But she responded saying, the Republican Party's best and brightest is back at it today, I see. Yes, bright enough to power a solar panel, I think. And she further said, CC, the president, a vulnerable and easily riled man who chooses to govern by conspiracy memes shared on Facebook instead of actual briefing data, which is true and refers to something else we were talking about. But also, fundamentally, likes the sort of media that Gateway Pundit is and doesn't want analysis that goes any deeper than, hey, I think I've successfully trolled the libs.
Mm-hmm. They're desperate. They are desperate. Mm-hmm. To discredit her in every possible way. And that desperation is bred by fear of how many people support all of the things that she stands for.
Yeah. Yeah, and it leads them to say stupid stuff like solar panels are bad. I get it. Maybe you like cars that use a lot of gasoline or something. Maybe you don't have a big problem with coal, but why would you hate solar panels? I mean, assuming this guy's a homeowner, you can save money in the long run by having solar panels. Like, why would that be a bad thing? Even if you don't believe climate change is a bad thing, you probably don't love pollution, right? Why wouldn't you want more renewable energy? But anyway,
be
as stupid as that
was. You hate innovations that make your life better.
Exactly, exactly. Not to attack
not
the Amish.
Not to attack
so far,
the Amish.
They've been good on this.
Sorry,
but anyway,
Amish.
And also they produce far fewer carbon emissions than other people, so I'll give them credit for that.
Stupid.
Now, as stupid as what Jim Holt has said is, imagine being the next person to make that stupid point on the same day in a more high profile watched environment. We've got one on Fox News.
They have this new Green Deal or whatever, okay, where they want to eliminate all oil and gas in 10 years.
Yeah, 10 years.
If you're in the polar vortex, how are you going to stay warm? With solar panels? Are you going to drive a Prius through a foot of snow? Absolutely not. And they want to tax estates. So I have to give my kids half of my estate when I die, which will be a national tragedy.
Yeah, no, they don't want to tax estates. We do tax estates, and we have for like 100 years in this country. But anyway, moving back to the other points, how he was stupider than the Gateway Pundit there. How are you going to heat your homes with solar panels? Yeah, a lot of people responded saying, I have solar panels. I'm in Chicago, and my house is a nice 72 degrees right
but
now.
Also, his logic is like, how are you going to use electricity if you're not inside a coal plant? Like, it's not going to be cloudy always everywhere. Mm-hmm. And even if it is cloudy, UV
you can still use solar.
It's not going to be night always everywhere. That is the only way. If it were night always everywhere, that is the way Jesse Waters.
I'll be on his side then.
Would be right. Jesse Waters is the worst.
He's really
bad. He is the worst half-thought hack ass comedian who's not a comedian. Go back and watch his original things on the O'Reilly Factor, where all he's doing is asking, as I was saying earlier, buzzword questions, not even having the responses that merit laughing at man on the street, and then playing a movie quote.
Yeah.
He went straight from those first two things to, like, who are the ad wizards who came up with the estate tax?
Yeah.
Like, he's just bundling together things that people desperate for a yuck on Fox News after a bunch of, you know, attacks on perfectly rational people.
Yeah, yeah, which he is not one of. He is awful. So he says about the solar panels. He also talks about the Priuses. Who's going to drive their Prius in a foot of snow? First of all, Priuses use gas. So that's how do you not know that? They've been out for like 20 years at this point. You don't know that they use gas. Second of all, any passenger car is going to be difficult to use with a lot of snow, but people in Chicago have Honda Civics.
Right.
Nobody knows. Even the people at that panel know what he's actually trying to say there.
There are hybrid even plug-in SUVs.
Yeah.
Your ability to navigate difficult terrain is not completely dependent on the source of energy of the car.
Exactly.
You dumb, dumb idiot.
Yes. And also, if this comes up again, bring up this next graphic. Antarctica turning to solar, wind power. Very interesting news that came out in 2009. Hasn't disseminated yet. They even use it on Mars. Brett, thank you for joining me.
Happy half hour at 5 today.
Thank you for watching. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.